Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 21st of December. Not that anyone really thinks of these days as the week beginning on Sunday. We don't really have the familiar rhythm of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday this week. Christmas shatters all that into glittering fragments. Half the days this week are the final days leading up to Christmas. They are so busy leading up to it that they don't really have any personality apart from doing that job. Then comes Christmas Day with its blinding light, and then in the sparkling debris come the two saints closest to Jesus, Stephen, who was the first to bear witness after the ascension and was martyred for it, and then John, the disciple Jesus loved. This Sunday may be the start of 7 days of chaos, but at least it still is a Sunday, and it has readings at Mass, and the readings are very suitable for the final Sunday before Christmas. Its Gospel answers the question we all have at one time or another when thinking about the Annunciation, when Gabriel came to Mary and got her permission for what was about to happen. What about Joseph? Joseph wasn't forgotten, and Sunday's Gospel tells the story. As for Sunday's first reading, that is a very strange piece of Isaiah. For most of us it is so familiar from carol services and everything that we don't notice the fact, but it is strange. The tail end of the passage is the bit we all remember. The virgin shall conceive and bear a son and name him Emmanuel. It is what happens at the beginning of the reading that has me puzzled. Ahaz, king of Judah, is being told what to do by Isaiah. Then the Lord tells Ahaz to ask for a sign, and Ahaz says, "No, I will not put the Lord to the test." Now we all remember that when the devil tempts Jesus to jump off the top of the temple, Jesus replies, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." So every time I hear this reading, I expect to hear that Ahaz has said the right thing. But no, the Lord, or Isaiah, loses his temper and says, "You are going to have a sign whether you want one or not." And then comes the prophecy about the virgin, which, about 700 years later, turned out to have been a prophecy of Christ being born of Mary. But that's 700 years later. Back there in the 8th century BC, it still seems as if poor Ahaz can't do anything right. Some commentators say that Ahaz is being told to check that Isaiah's prophecy is sealed, stamped, and certified, a genuine prophecy because God gives a sign to confirm it. But I don't know. Those commentators seem to be reading a lot into very few words. It strikes me that there is a way in which you and I can borrow this incident and make use of it in our own lives. Jesus is forever telling us to pray and ask God for things. There is asking for bread and not getting a stone. There is the parable of the woman and the unjust judge. And yet, in practice, we hold back. We say, like Ahaz, "I will not put the Lord to the test." I read an interview once with an Italian footballer, the sort of pious boy you see crossing himself as he runs onto the pitch. The interviewer asked, "When you are about to take a penalty that will decide the match, do you send up a prayer?" And the footballer replied, "No, I wouldn't want to bother God with a little thing like that." That is charming and polite, but the inspiration I get from this incident in Isaiah is that God is telling us to bother him, that not bothering him is wrong. It can be difficult to pray for things. I remember a small child whose father went to hospital with a nosebleed, and the child went in terror for the 2 days it took because it couldn't ask, "Is Daddy going to die?" because that would make it all too real. It can be exactly like that with prayer. There are things that we want too much, so that even to name them, even name them silently to God, is to remind ourselves how much we want them and how terrible it would be if we didn't get them. Still, God says ask, so we must. In the worst case, try telling God this: "I want to ask you for something, but I can't. Please, give it to me." If it's the best you can do, it's the best you can do. He knows you, he knows what you want, and he knows what you need. He knows you are doing your best, and you can't do more than that. The great countdown of the O antiphons at Vespers continues, And even though Sunday is a Sunday, the fact that it is Christmas Eve minus three is more important. The antiphon says, O rising sun, you are the splendour of eternal light and the sun of justice. Come and enlighten those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. All that darkness sounds odd, given that this is Christmas, the festival of light, but it shows that Christmas is not just a nice thing to have. Christmas is needed. Now the light of Christmas is very near. Jesus is nearly here. Earlier in the antiphons we were asking to be let out of our prison. Now we are looking for the light to come and shine into the prison itself. Isaiah sees this future as something in the present. The people that walked in darkness has seen a great light. On those who live in the land of deep shadow, a light has shone. Monday the 22nd is Christmas Eve minus two. O King of the peoples, whom they long for, the cornerstone, who make the two into one, come and save man, whom you made from clay. Now the Christmas story has spread. The story has spread in time. It isn't limited any more to just the time from the prophets to the birth of Jesus. It stretches back to the beginning of everything, with man whom you made with clay. It stretches forward to the end of everything, because that title, King of the Peoples, is an echo of what we celebrated 4 weeks ago at the feast of Christ the King. Christ the King was about the King of the universe. This antiphon is about the King of all peoples. That is to say, Christmas has spread in space, not just time, far beyond just the story of the God of Abraham, the God of the Jews. Our scope is not one patriarch any more, not even one race, but everyone. Why does the antiphon say cornerstone? Because a cornerstone keeps two walls together and stops them from collapsing. The King binds the whole universe together in just the same way. For one thing, he binds all races together. For another thing, his incarnation raises matter up and binds it to spirit. There may be other images you can think of, but it all adds up to the same thing. The ruler of the universe will unite all things in himself. The antiphon also says, Man whom you made from clay, because the world that ends, held together by a cornerstone, began in dust. That comes straight from the book of Genesis. The Lord God fashioned man of dust from the soil, and he became a living being. It also echoes Isaiah, the prophet of Christmas, when he says, We are the clay, you the potter, we are all the work of your hand. We are dust, we are clay, we are even the mud that the potter is going to bake, and God is rock. Come and save man, says the antiphon, which is to say again, we are in trouble and need saving. It is always worth remembering this at Christmas. God came because we needed him. If we remember the need without the coming, we are in despair. If we remember the coming without the need, we lose ourselves in fatuous jollity. But if we remember both the need and the coming, we rejoice because we truly have something to rejoice about. Tuesday the 23rd is Christmas Eve minus one. It brings the final O antiphon, which throws away all the delightful images that went before and gets to the heart of the matter at once. O Emmanuel, the name means God with us. O God with us, you are our King and our Judge, the one whom the peoples await and their Saviour. O come and save us, Lord our God. Come and save us. In the end, Christmas is about nothing else. This huge thing we are celebrating, this thing we have been looking forward to for weeks, it is not a royal visit, it is a rescue mission. We aren't getting this because we deserve it, but because we need it. The 24th is not Christmas Eve minus anything. It is just Christmas Eve. At Vespers there's no special antiphon, because liturgically it is not even Christmas Eve any more. It is already Christmas. Christianity is Judaism fulfilled. The Jews start their big days the night before. The Sabbath starts on Friday evening. So we Christians do the same. The evening Mass on Saturday is the Sunday Mass. Vespers on Saturday are the first Vespers of Sunday. And so, at Vespers on Christmas Eve, we aren't counting down any more because we are already at Christmas. Civilized countries take this seriously. As a boy in Poland, my father would spend half of Christmas Eve afternoon at the window, watching for the first star to appear, because when the sky got dark enough for that, Christmas had come at last, and it was time for the 12-course Christmas feast to begin. Now let's look at the significance of Christmas another way. Here is a question that annoyingly clever people sometimes ask. Which is more important, Christmas or Easter? It is quite easy to work out what answer they expect and what they think the right answer is. They expect the answer Christmas so that they can tell us we are wrong and Easter is more important. Ordinary, uneducated people send Christmas cards, not Easter cards. We give Christmas presents, not Easter presents. We sing Christmas carols, not Easter carols, and so on. So, say these clever people, the ordinary, uneducated people say that Christmas is more important. Consequently, we say Easter, because we are clever, so we are right. It is a silly fight, really, but to the extent that people take it seriously, Mary has the answer about the cleverness of the clever people. In the Magnificat, she says, "He has torn powers from their thrones, but lifted up the humble." Those words are great protection against all sorts of experts. Mary has told us something we all need to remember, that Christianity is not just for the clever, but for everyone, not just the few, but the many, and sometimes the many are right. At Christmas they may rejoice without knowing why they are rejoicing, but they are still right to rejoice. And the many really are right. To start with, the liturgy tells us. Every Sunday at Mass we stand to recite the Creed. Every Sunday we bow low for certain words in the Creed. Sometimes we even kneel for them. What are those words? Not the crucifixion and the resurrection, the Easter events. It's actually the opposite, because the crucifixion marks the moment when we stand up straight again after we have been bowing. We bow when God the Son is incarnate of the Virgin Mary and becomes man. In other words, when we bow, it is because of Christmas. The liturgy takes us through to theology. Who or what is Jesus? If Jesus had been purely human, then the clever people would have been right. His birth wouldn't have been different for anyone else's, and all the importance would have gone to the events of Easter. But the Son of God is God. God is pure spirit, and infinite, and eternal. It would be a miracle to squeeze the infinite power which made the universe and sun and stars into a small animal body, to squeeze pure spirit into an uneasy hybrid of body and soul, to have omnipotence itself embrace powerlessness to make the Creator be one of his own creatures. More than a miracle, it seems impossible, outrageous. If you have any sense at all of the dignity and superiority of God, it is just wrong. Huge numbers of people in the early centuries did indeed find this doctrine disgusting and unacceptable, and they denied it. They denied it in various ways. Some of them decided that Jesus was not God and man, but God only. That meant that this whole business of being human was just a performance. Jesus was something like an angel in disguise, just pretending to be human. It was all a pantomime put on to make us feel happy. The trouble was, that meant God was deceiving us, and everything about Jesus' life on earth was a lie. Then again, other people insisted that Jesus was not God and man, but purely human. Whenever in the Gospels he said that he was God the Son, he was mad, or lying, or misunderstood, or perhaps the evangelists were the ones who were lying and faking. It doesn't matter exactly which explanation you pick, any of them will do as long as you avoid the scandal of God made man. The Arian heresy said that Jesus was just a created being, and we had a big fight with the Arians in the early centuries. That war lasted a long time, but in the end we won because we were right. Jesus Christ is true God and true man. We had to be right, because to deny the truth of God made man is to take us back to how we all were in the years BC, when God looked dispassionately down from on high on us struggling about in the mud of the world. Sometimes he gave advice, sometimes he encouraged, sometimes he punished, but it was all strictly bloodless and hygienic. The distance between heaven and earth was unbridgeable. God was not involved. You can still call what God did love if you want to, but only love by remote control. The incarnation, God being made man, was an act of love on an infinite scale. No wonder we celebrate it the way we do. And more than love, the Lord, the cornerstone, unites matter and spirit. Sometimes people try to say that the spirit is, well, more spiritual, and that matter is somehow just a mucky mistake. They try to rise above matter. They say we should do the same. At the incarnation, God the Son did the opposite. He did not rise above matter, he dived into it and became made of it. Because matter is holy too. The Holy One made it at the beginning of time. And we are both matter and spirit, and to try to be one and not the other is like trying to run on one leg. Again, the incarnation explains everything and changes our understanding of God and ourselves forever. Again, we are right to celebrate it as much as we do. Inevitably, after Christmas, the rest of the week feels like an anticlimax. But at the very least, it is interesting to see what saints the Church has chosen to celebrate just next to the birth of Jesus in the calendar. Would you have made the same choice? On Friday the 26th, St. Stephen is the first martyr to bear witness to the risen Christ. He saw heaven thrown open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. His feast day is also a kind of sideways feast of St. Paul, who stood by and helped Stephen's killers by looking after their clothes. I love the later echo of this in 1535. I have mentioned it already this year, but the story is worth repeating. Sir Thomas More was found guilty of treason by judges who were too afraid of King Henry VIII to do anything else. In his final speech to them, he compared himself to St. Stephen and them to St. Paul. I don't think such a severe reproach has ever been delivered in the form of quite such an elegant compliment. On Saturday the 27th is St. John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. The other evangelists are scattered over the year, but John is here as close as he can be to his beloved master. He lay next to him at the Last Supper, and after the crucifixion he looked after Jesus' mother as if she were his own. John wrote his gospel as an old man in exile on the island of Patmos. The other evangelists had already reported the events well enough, so John was, in a sense, free. He could look back on what happened from the other end of a long life, a life spent reflecting on everything that had happened. We do that ourselves sometimes, and then events long ago take a meaning which we never saw at the time because we were too close to them. This is what happens with John. His gospel is full of understanding of what it was all about. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense and a truly glorious Christmas full of real rejoicing, and let's pray for one another.